With our story here today of David, it's a story that we can look at and almost see it in a really sad, negative way. And yet we can also look at it in a positive way. And I think if you know my teaching enough, you know I prefer to look at it at what God is doing and how we see His hand. So that's how I want to look at the story today. But let's go back a bit. We're still on the story of Absalom. How did you like all the characters? Are you able to keep track of who's who? Well, let's start with Absalom. He's kind of the main character. Absalom is David's which son? Third son. Third son, next in line for the throne, because his first son, Amnon, was the oldest, and he was killed by Absalom. Daniel we don't hear much about, because he probably died in infancy, and Absalom then is the next in line. So that's where you would probably come up with the second son. But he's really the third son, but he's in line for the throne. At this point of our story, it looks like he's very much in control, right? He's probably had a pretty successful coup. He's sitting in Jerusalem. He's in the palace. He's had the king's concubines. He's got the king's two advisors beside him. Everything's going his way. The king's in exile, but there's one little detail left. He has to get rid of the king. So he has to go to battle. And that's what we saw last week, where Achithophel, who was David's top aide, had advised him to go right away. And he would have been successful, but God confused him, and we find that David is given a little reprieve in that Absalom waits. But we saw this appeal to his ego, right? Get the whole army together, and you lead them personally, and you do all these things. And so Absalom did that. And then last week we saw that David's men had the advantage. They're seasoned warriors. Who are Absalom's warriors? They're really farmers that are getting called into battle. So they're not seasoned warriors like David's men. And they take the advantage of the forest. That's where skill plays in. Numbers doesn't make any difference. It's skill. And of course we saw that David's men were the ones that were able to win the battle decisively. And Absalom, his pride and joy was his undoing, wasn't it? Interesting, Absalom died hanging on a tree, didn't he? It was his hair that caught. He's there absolutely helpless, and Job comes and finishes him off. We ended our story there last week because the issue of who's going to tell King David is a big issue. Did you notice you got four verses given to the discussion in detail as to who's going to tell David? Because this is a really important issue. And we even had a conversation going on now. Who is Ahimaas? He's the priest's son, and he wants to be the runner. He wants to go bring the news. Any idea why Ahimaas wants to bring the news to David? If you think about it, he's the one that had been sent to David, right? He was part of the network. David had left the priest, and he says, get word to me. Well, Ahimaas had been the one who had been the runner. He had gone to David and told him all about Absalom's plans. And he had stayed with him. And now he wanted to bring him the news saying, your victory, you won, you have it. But Joab knows David very well, doesn't he? He says, this isn't going to be good news. This isn't what he wants to hear. And he sends a Cushite, a foreigner. He says, I want you to be the eyewitness. You just go tell him what you've seen. He's going to tell it in a very unemotional way because Ahimaas knows David, knows the family, knows the sons. It's going to be a little different. So he heads off and Ahimaas keeps pleading with Joab. He says, let me go. And Joab says, why do you want to go? This isn't good news. Did you see his answer? He basically said, just because, I want to go. By this time, the Cushite had enough advantage heading over there, and so he said, all right, run. Apparently, Ahimaas was the one that you would see jogging around Jerusalem in the morning and in the evening, because everybody knew not only that he ran, but they even knew his style. Did you notice that? And he takes the valley route. Now it's longer, but it's flat. And with his speed and his ability as a marathoner, he gets there before the Cushite, who actually goes the direct route, but over the hills and through difficult terrain. And where's David? Sitting at the city gate. Can you imagine? This is probably the most important battle in David's life. It's the battle for his throne. It's a battle against his own son. And he can't go. He can't even see what's going on. They don't have CNN. So there he is sitting at the city gate. Now we've talked about the city gate. City gates can be 10 feet, 12 feet, 15 feet, even 30 feet wide. And I used to think they were solid. I thought, wow, they really were quite the construction. But they weren't. There were an inner wall and an outer wall. And in between these walls are rooms. And they served as like what we would call the city hall or the courtyard. And people would come there and do their businesses or else have their cases judged. It was in that room that David was sitting. Now these rooms are also two-story high. On top of that would be another room, that's the guardhouse. And the watchtower is there, so the watchmen and the guards would be on the room above it. And between the second floor and the first floor is an opening in the floor. There's a hole. That way they can talk to each other. And so it was in that configuration. David's down below, sitting, waiting, watching at the gate for the first sign of anybody that comes in. And the watchman's on the tower, and he says, "A runner's coming." And David says, "One runner. Good news." The watchman says, "And here comes another runner." Okay, now you got two runners. David says, "Oh, another single runner. Must be good news." What's David expecting? Good news. He's not anticipating anything less than good news. Well, the runner arrives. And the first one is his friend Ahimaas. Oh, if Ahimaas, it's good news because he's a good man. Notice what Ahimaas says. He says, "All is well. Praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered you up, the men who lifted your hands against the Lord the king." Good news. Well, David's expecting that part of the good news. He says, "But what about my son?" Joab had already prepped Ahimaas. He knew that he didn't want to hear this. So he avoids the issue altogether. He says, "You know, when I was leaving, there was a little bit of ruckus going on, and there were some conversations, and I really didn't hear the end of it, so I don't know." And he says, "Well, step aside, because the other guy's coming. Surely he'll have news." And when he comes, he says the same thing Ahimaas does. "Good news. Praise the Lord. He's given you the victory." And he says, "But what about my son?" The Cushite must have been prepped by Joab too, because notice he mentions neither like this young man. It was like somebody punched David in the stomach. That wasn't the news he was expecting. He had given a direct command, "Don't mess with my son." You see, he has in his mind what's going to happen. This is just a youthful rebellion. They're going to capture him. He's going to bring him back. He's going to slap his wrist, maybe put him in his house under house arrest again, and he's going to run on, and everything's going to be just fine. But he's not living in the real world. This isn't an innocent young man. This man was his son, but he was trying to kill him and take over his kingdom. But David can't see that. He's got blinders on. And he goes upstairs into the guardhouse. And I want you to see the positions he's in. He has a coat or whatever, a garment. It's over his head. Actually, that's where we get the widow's veil from later. But he's in isolation. He can't see. Nobody can see him. And he starts wailing, so he can't hear anything. I don't know if you've experienced a death very close to you, but when my father died, the most unexpected thing happened to me, because I'm not a person that's very loud and boisterous. I started wailing like I'd never wailed before. In fact, my husband shut the windows and doors because it was so loud, and I don't even know where it came from, but it came from my toes. And it was totally unexpected. And this is what David was doing. He couldn't see, he couldn't hear, he was isolated with his pain. And there he sat. Well, the sad part is the army had to come back in through those very gates. And I'll tell you, if you were a mile away, you knew exactly what was happening. And as they come in through the gate, they hear their king wailing, and it says they're ashamed. They had gone and done what they had been required to do. They put their lives on the line, and yet they came home ashamed. We talked about this in our leaders' council, and Ildiko says, "It kind of reminds me of Vietnam." Haven't experienced that, very much so. So we can understand what they were feeling. Joab, the man of the hour, knows the situation. You see, Joab is not caught up in the personalness of it. He's looking at the nation, and he's got a nation now leaderless. Any situation leaderless will not remain so for very long. Family, church, business, country, there will be somebody who will step in, and Joab knows it. So Joab goes up to David, and I can just picture this in my mind. He takes off his cover. He probably takes his hands in his face, and he says, "David, look at me. Look at me. Listen to what I have to say. Do you realize what you're doing?" He says, "Those men out there just gave their life for you, and look at what you're doing. You're humiliating your men. You're acting as if those who love you, you hate, and those who hate you, you love." And he says, "Every man out there risked his life, and yet you wish he was dead, and the one who tried to kill you was alive." And I have a feeling he said, "Now shape up and be a king." And then he gives him a command with not a very veiled threat. He says, "Now you go down there and you encourage your men." And then he takes an oath. "Or in the name of the Lord, your man won't be in there in the morning." And I have a feeling he's basically telling David, "I will make sure, because I will personally lead them out." And I have a feeling David knew Joab could do that. Don't you? Do we question Joab's ability to do this? I don't think so. So David goes downstairs, and he sits at the gate. But how long has it taken? Nobody's around. They have to send for the men. The men come. No conversation recorded. Nothing said. Only then they come before their king, and he does commend them for what they did. You see, these men, if David is not king, are traitors. What's their lot in light if David doesn't come back as king? They're under the death sentence. They're in a lose-lose situation. They risked it all for a king who doesn't care. Joab was good in what he did. Well, at this point, David could have just walked back into Jerusalem. Did it surprise you that he didn't? He stays there, I think, and, well, why doesn't he go back? He's king now. Absalom's dead. There's a bit of confusion going on back in Jerusalem and all around. There's a discussion going on. You know, this king we just anointed is dead, and the other king's in exile, and should we call him back or shouldn't we? Some of them are saying, well, you know, he's no longer any good. And others have said, well, man, he's the one that saved us from the Philistines. And there's a discussion going on. And word gets to David that they aren't quite unified yet. So what does David do? He sends to his own tribe. And he sends message to Zadok, who's the priest, probably by Ahimaas, his runner. And he says, tell them this. Remind them that we're brothers, that we're kin, that we're flesh and blood. And also say this, say Amasa will be the commander. So Ahimaas runs off, tells Zadok, who calls all the elders together. And notice after that, they join together as one man and send word to David, come back, you and all your men. What was it? Was it that he reminded them that they were flesh and blood? I don't think so. I think it was that he said, Amasa is going to be the commander-in-chief. Why? Amasa was Absalom's commander-in-chief. He was the traitor. He was the one leading the troops against David. David basically says, I'm extending amnesty to him. And what do they think? Well, if he's getting amnesty, David's going to give it to us. We don't have to be afraid, because otherwise they could be considered traitors. David come back and wipe them all out, because they'd helped his son Absalom rebel. So David prepares to come back. The men of Judah send for him. And I want us to get this picture, because crossing the Jordan River coming back is a big deal. Remember when Israel crossed the Jordan coming into the Promised Land? That was God's gift coming to the land of inheritance. David's crossing is very much the same, ceremonially coming back into the land. So the crossing of the Jordan is a big deal. Notice who wants to be there. All these people that we saw when David was going are back again. Only now it's a little different story. Notice who's first. Shimei? Remember that guy, the one that was cursing and throwing rocks at David and said, you're getting what's your due? The traitor? He comes with 1,000 men from Benjamin. Now, they're all from the house of Saul, the last king. And I'm thinking about this. I wonder if those 1,000 men were related to him and maybe were afraid that his rebellion was going to rub off on them and they were going to all be killed. Because quite often, when a man did something, his whole family died, his whole clan. So maybe they're protecting themselves. Notice who else comes along with him. Ziba, Mephibosheth's servant. How come he's linked up with Shimei? Apparently they were linked even from the last time. We just didn't see that. And I can just picture this. Okay, David and his group's on the other side of the Jordan, the Transjordan side. And here comes Shimei, barreling as fast as he can. It says he rushed. He doesn't even stop at the Jordan. He just comes barreling in, comes out the other side, and falls in a puddle in front of the king and says, I've sinned. He confesses. He says, I did it. I know I did it. But he's asking for amnesty. Abishai's with David. Abishai and Joab, those wonderful brothers that David really can't do without, but he wonders how he can handle them. They're strong men, aren't they? Abishai had wanted to wipe him out, right? The first time. He said, let me take him out, David. And David said, no, you know, maybe God sent him. After all, my son's rebelling, why not Shimei? Now Abishai says, all right, he's just convicted himself. He's just confessed that he's a rebel. Let me carry out the death sentence now. Notice David's response. He says, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Jerusalem, who is his sister? He says, you've become my adversaries. He says, every time I'm trying to do something, you want to do something else. He says, are you my friend? Are you my enemy? Then he turns to this man who's in a puddle at his feet. Now, Abishai and David are looking at the same man in the same condition. Abishai sees a traitor. He wants to kill him. David sees a man in repentance and forgives. He says, I forgive you. I've given you back your life. How could David do that? I think because David had been in that position. God should have taken David's life, but he didn't. And David understands that, and he's able to give amnesty to Shimei. Well, the next one who comes along is Ziba. He's got something at stake too. But notice who comes with Ziba. Mephibosheth. Now, Mephibosheth we know is lame. He's Jonathan's son. He's the one that should have been killed when David took over, but was protected by his nurse, but in her fleeing had crushed his feet. And David had extended not only amnesty to him, he'd made him a prince. He'd taken him to his very family. Mephibosheth can't cross the Jordan on his own, so he rides his donkey, but he plods across and comes to David too. And what does he say? David looks at him and says, well, where have you been? And he wants to set the record straight, and he says, I was trying to come, but obviously I can't run with you. By the time I got my donkey, I knew what Ziba had done, and he's betrayed me. Now, David doesn't know what to do. He's got Ziba, who obviously came to him and provided him food, showing his gratefulness to David, and he's got Mephibosheth. Two stories, two men. David thinks it must be the issue of the land, so he says, well, it was Mephibosheth, and I gave it to Ziba before because of the situation. He says, I don't have time to judge this. I don't have time to sit down and get the facts, so divide the land. Now, if it was really about the land issue and wanting something for yourself, I think Mephibosheth would have left it there. But Mephibosheth doesn't, does he? You see, he's really, truly interested in the king. And he says, I don't care about the land. Give it all to him. He says, what's important to me is you, David, because I deserve to die, and yet you took me in. And he says, I'm happy just to know you're safe. Well, looking at him, David would have recognized that he was probably telling the truth, because you saw he hadn't taken care of himself. If he'd have been interested in the land, and if what Ziba had said, maybe he would have come out in David's robes. I mean, after all, he had access to the palace. But he didn't. In fact, if you notice, he didn't even wash his clothes. He must have been something. Especially if you're mourning and all this kind of stuff. Incidentally, they figured David was in exile maybe 2 weeks, probably not more than a month, so we aren't talking about years here. We are talking about a relatively short period of time. One more man, Barzillai. This was kind of fun because we didn't get a lot of information about him, did we, before, but now we find out that he's 80 years old and that he's actually been providing for David and all his men in his household the whole time. He must have had extreme wealth because he took out of what he had to make sure that the king had what he needed. And so David now wants to reward Barzillai. And he says, come with me to the palace. I'm going to give you a life of luxury like you wouldn't believe. And Barzillai says, I appreciate your gratitude, David, but at this point, I can't see well, I can't hear well, and I can't even taste. And he says, I think it would be kind of a burden to you. It wouldn't be much good for me. So he says, I prefer to stay here in my own home because then I can be with my people when I die. But he says, would you take my son in my place? Bestow upon him all the gifts that you would give me. And David does that. We're going to see as we continue on to Kings that he's actually given a city near Bethlehem. But David doesn't end it there. He basically says, Barzillai, you got a blank check. If there's anything you need, just get word to me. And then he takes him and kisses him and gives him a blessing. David is now ready to cross the Jordan River. And the men of Judah all come. This was probably full of pomp and circumstance, but that's not what the story was about. So he crosses the river, I'm sure royally, and he proceeds to Jerusalem. By this time, all the rest of Israel has got their act together, and they come down. They're ready to take him across the river, but they're too late. They come down there, and they start in. Don't they sound like a bunch of kids? They're arguing as to who's more loyal to David. They said, we're more loyal because there's 10 more of us and there's only 2 of you. Incidentally, the 2 they're talking about is Judah and Simeon. Because if you remember how the promised land was divided up, Simeon's territory is within Judah. So when they refer to the 2, it's Judah and Simeon, even though we know Saul's house of Benjamin is there somewhat. And they start arguing. Well, Judah has the trump card and they play it. Yeah, but he's flesh and blood with us. Notice what a man named Sheba does. They can't compete with that, so he basically turns the tables on them and he says, we have no part in David, we have no dealing with the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent. And you're going, tents? What are they talking about? This is a rallying cry from when they were conquering Israel originally. What he's doing is he's drawing on their history. And by what he says, he knows very well. And all of them follow him. And they leave. So David and the tribe of Judah go back to Jerusalem and he settles in. But there's one little problem there. When he gets there, the 10 concubines that were used as part of the rebellion are still there. It's really sad and unfortunate for these women because they did what the king said and stayed behind. And they were used as part of the rebellion. But because they are, they're under the judgment. And they were to be executed as being part of the rebellion. But David's not in the mood for killing anybody. He's in the mood for amnesty. And so what he does is he takes these women and he places them in a home, in the palace, in luxury, but in confinement for the rest of their lives. They're basically imprisoned within a house, but well provided for. That was the best he could do at that point. So David's back in Jerusalem and he realizes that he still has Sheba out there. And so he calls Amasa for his first order from the king, right? He's the new general, the new commander of the whole army. And he says, gather all the armies and be back here in 3 days. So Amasa goes. And for some reason, he's unable to do that. And I wondered if maybe they weren't too willing to come. You know, maybe they didn't know whether they were going to fight with David or not. And the third day comes and he doesn't show up. David's not one to sit around because he knows the score. You allow Sheba to get going and he's going to have the same deal all over again. So who does he turn to? Not General Joab, because he's already been demoted, right? He turns to his brother Abishai and he says, take the royal troops and go pursue Sheba. Abishai goes, but who else goes with him in his full general's garb? Did you notice that? Joab, he's got everything on, down to the sword, the whole thing. So off they go. Well, Amasai finally shows up and he's sent off again and he reaches him up at about Gibeah. Notice Joab's response. They're cousins, all three of these men. They're relatives. And he goes up to him and he says, hello, brother. And he grabs him by the beard. Now, to me, that seemed like a very hostile action, but it's really not. Culturally, it's like us going out and putting our arm around somebody and saying, how you doing? Notice how conveniently his sword falls out. Basically, I'm unarmed. Amasa receives the embrace, not realizing that Joab has a dagger in his other hand. One swift jab and he's done. What happens to Abishai? Disappears from history at this point. Joab is full command of David's armies, and no one will come against him again. So he takes off, and it's a united army under Joab, and he heads up. Did you look on a map where Abel is? It's as far north as you can go. You see, Sheba went all the way through the land trying to rally supports, and the only support he got was the Bearites, who were probably his own personal family and clan, and he made it as far north as the city of Abel in Dan. Now, Abel is known, even back in Genesis, as a city of wisdom. So he's holed up in there. The gates are closed. Joab builds a siege ramp, and now we see what it is. He basically piles dirt up against the walls so that he can get a siege ramp, or a battering ram as we know them, all the way up to the top where it's more vulnerable. And he starts banging on the walls, breaking it down from the top. There's a wise woman in the town. Don't you love it? And she goes up to the watchtower and she yells down for whoever's in charge here because she wants to talk to him. And notice Joab comes over. Now, I thought this was interesting because Joab, we know, is a pretty tough cookie, right? But who did Joab send to speak to David when he wanted him to bring Absalom back? He went to a wise woman. So apparently Joab didn't have any problems with wise woman. He was just a tough military, follow the letter and the law, except if it doesn't suit him, type of guy. So this wise woman calls down to him, and she plays off of his name. You see, Joab's name means Yahweh is Father. And she's yelling down, "Hey, Yahweh's father, why are you coming against the mother here? We're a mother in Israel. We're peaceful. We take care of all the little villages around here. We've been faithful to the crown the whole time. Why are you trying to come in and to destroy our inheritance? Why is the father coming against the mother?" And he goes, "Oh, no, that's not what we're doing at all here." He says, "What we're really about is you've got a traitor in there." So she says, "All right, if that's the deal, then you'll have his head tomorrow." And she follows through. Joab blows the trumpet. The rebellion's over, as is the end of David's kingdom. You see, that's the end of the record of David as king. We get his cabinet. The end of his reign, did you notice the difference between the beginning of the reign? I hope you looked closely at that, because the beginning of the reign, it says David led, and he was leading with justice and what was right, and then it lists the military and the priests. At the end, Joab, followed by the bodyguards, followed by a new position, a department of forced labor. Why do we need that? Because they've conquered so many people that they need to have just a department to take care of that. Now, forced labor, I want you to understand, is not slavery. Israel was not into slaves. Forced labor means they were forced to pay the king. They were forced to labor in order to pay him. They were living in their own lands, but they were now servants of the king rather than servants to their own personal king. David was their king. So that's important to know. But the top four positions now are all military. What was David's role in the kingdom of Israel? It was to take all that God had promised to Abraham and make it happen. He was a warrior king. His reign ends at chapter 20, and what we have in 21 to 24 is basically the epilogue, the details. His death actually doesn't even occur until we get into Kings, because that's the beginning of the story of Solomon, and it's important over there. I was thinking about this, and I thought, oh, the first 10 chapters of David's reign were so good. He did so well. In fact, that's all we really need, because that's the conquest. Chapters 11 through 20 begin with his affair with Bathsheba, and it shows the consequences of the sin. I thought, how appropriate. We should have been studying this when the media was trying to tell us that President Clinton's affair had no effect on the country. It was just his personal life. I think the Bible answers this very clearly here, doesn't it? You see, David's personal life affected every single person in Israel and how he ruled his country, and I think the Bible is very clear, because it took 10 chapters, the same amount of time to tell how God's promise that they were going to capture the entire land is given 10 chapters, but 10 chapters is given to the consequences of sin and how it affected one king and his rule. I think that says a lot, doesn't it? His family really suffered. We can look at David two ways. We can look at David as a powerful king who was a great warrior and did as God asked him to, but we can look at David as a man who was really kind of bad, failed a lot. God calls David a man after his own heart. Doesn't really fit like it should as we're studying it, does it? It's kind of like, how did he see that? But let me tell you what I saw this time, because I'm glad God has a heart like David. And he doesn't have a heart like Joab. Because you see, David learned an awful lot from his failures. David was under the death sentence several times according to the law. And if Joab had been king, David would have been dead. He would have been dead for adultery, for coveting, and for murder, and a whole host of other things. But you see, God's heart was different. He was able to forgive. And so David learned forgiveness and pardon. And when Shimei came, he could say, "Yeah, you were a traitor, but I forgive you." And when Ziba came and Mephibosheth, he says, "Yeah, I can forgive you." And when Joab and Abishai said, "Wipe them out," he says, "Where are you coming from? Have you never been forgiven in your life? Don't you understand?" There's a story that I want to read you. Swindell has this book on David, which is very interesting because he takes a totally different tack than I did. So if you want to read the book and get a different viewpoint, you can. But he tells a story about John D. Rockefeller. It's kind of an interesting story. He says, John D. Rockefeller is the man who built the great Standard Oil empire. Not surprising, Rockefeller was a man who demanded high performance from his company executives. One day, one of those executives made a $2 million mistake. Word of the man's enormous error quickly spread throughout the executive offices, and the other men began to make themselves scarce, afraid of his reaction. They didn't even want to cross his path. One man didn't have a choice, though, because he had an appointment with the boss. So he straightened up his shoulders, he tightened his belt, and he walked into Rockefeller's office. As he approached the oil monarch's desk, Rockefeller looked up from the piece of paper upon which he was writing. "I guess you've heard about the $2 million mistake our friend made," he said abruptly. "Yes," the executive said, expecting Rockefeller to explode. "Well, I've been sitting here listing all of our friend's good qualities on this sheet of paper, and I've discovered that in the past he's made up many more times the amount he lost for us today by his one mistake. His good points far outweigh this one human error, so I think we ought to forgive him. Don't you?" I'd just like you to bow your heads, pray with me. Imagine, if you will, yourself in this story. Imagine that David is God, and you're Sheba, or Shimei. Let's start with Shimei. Have you ever come to a point where you've shaken your fist at God and said, "I don't understand what's going on, but I don't believe you're king anymore"? I'm sure glad God has the heart like David and he's willing to forgive. Or maybe you've been a Ziba, somebody who took advantage of a situation for your own personal gain. David forgave him too. What about Mephibosheth? Have you ever been in a position where you've been misunderstood? You're trying to do what's right, and all of a sudden it just seems like everything's turned against you and nobody can believe your story, or you're not even given a chance. Well, David forgave him too. What about Sheba? He rebelled. And David knew that he wasn't coming back. Joab finished him. I don't know if you identify with any of these men, but we certainly can identify with the employee. There's not one of us here that hasn't made a mistake. I'm glad David is a picture of our Lord. Somebody who has a heart that's compassionate. Somebody that forgives. Have you thanked God that he's not like Joab? Let's do that. Oh Lord, how thankful we are that you have a heart of compassion, that you see past all our mistakes and see the potential in each one of us. Lord, we fail you on a daily basis. Sometimes intentionally, sometimes not intentionally, but how we praise you that you uphold the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law. I pray that as we go through our lives that we would appreciate the love and forgiveness you've given to us, and that we would in turn be able to extend it to others and show your love. Thank you for dying for us and making us your own. You are the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Amen.